What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Ron Wolfson, Ph.D. and author of Relational Judaism. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The Olympics in Rio de Janeiro are well underway, and there is much to celebrate. Gold medals, world records, new heroes and heroines for the world, as there are at every Olympics. There are Jewish Olympic stars this year, too, American-born and Israeli both, and we'll talk about some of them. On a different note, though, as a Jew of a certain age, I cannot see an Olympic telecast and fail to remember the murder of the Israeli athletes at Munich back in 1972. We do well to remember the Palestinian Arab terrorists who committed that atrocity, and the fact that the Olympic authorities, the International Olympic Committee Chair Avery Brundage, an American, kept the games and ceremonies going with no real pause afterwards. Since then, Olympic memorials and reminders of that tragic past have been scarce from the not very humane folks on the International Olympic Committee. The IOC was urged very strongly to hold a ceremony 4 years ago in London at the 2012 Games for the 40th anniversary of the Munich massacre, but it refused, as it had refused for four decades. A local ceremony was held in London, including family members of the murdered athletes and some UK and London officials, but the IOC and the world press ignored it. Finally, this summer, that changed. It is a truly major accomplishment of the Rio Olympics. For the very first time in 44 years, just before the start of these games, August 4th, the International Olympic Committee offered its first official commemoration and memorial for the 11 Israeli Olympians murdered by Palestinian Arab terrorists in Munich, in Germany, in 1972. IOC President Thomas Bach led a ceremony mourning the deaths of the 11 Israelis and one German policeman brutally slain by Palestinian Arab terrorists. It inaugurated a place of mourning in the Athletes' Olympic Village in Rio. The Olympics in Rio have attempted to right this wrong. We are grateful that this long-ignored omission has been partially rectified. It's incredibly important to remember those who have been martyred, not only so that their memory continues in our own lives, but so that we don't allow these terrible events to be repeated. On a similar and somber theme today, we have an important day on the Jewish calendar. It's the commemoration of the 9th of Av, the fast day of Tisha B'Av, which remembers the destruction of both the First Temple by the Babylonians nearly 2,600 years ago and of the Second Temple by the Romans 1,946 years ago, as well as the burning of Jerusalem and the end of the independent Jewish state. It also marks the anniversary of the fall of Beitar, ending the last great Jewish revolt against Rome by Bar Kokhba in the year 135, and of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, fully effective on this Hebrew calendar date in 1492. A really dark day altogether in Jewish history. By tradition, this is a day when many Jews fast, remembering all this loss. In Israel, people congregate in the area of the Kotel, the Western Wall, holiest place on earth for Jews, the retaining wall holding up the sacred Temple Mount upon which our temple stood in ancient days. It is a sad, holy day, marked with mournful dirges, kinot, and the chanting of the deeply tragic book Eicha, Lamentations from the Bible, a recollection of the destructions inflicted on our people so many times on this date. This has been a day of true holocausts for our people over the centuries. Technically speaking, the ninth day of the month of Av was yesterday, Shabbat, But no fast day except for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is observed on the Sabbath. The fast and its observances are moved till last night and today, concluding tonight at sundown. Interestingly, the Reform movement in Judaism took Tisha B'Av out of the calendar, more or less. Reform rabbis believed that by so deeply mourning the destruction of the temple, where in ancient times ritual animal sacrifice was the central aspect of Jewish practice, we were maintaining that we wished to restore the rituals of the temple. That was not what the Reform movement desired, and still isn't. Nor, frankly, is it what most traditional Jews desire either, if the truth be told. We have evolved a very long way from the days when the appropriate form of prayer was grain or small birds or an occasional sheep offered as an elaborate form of sacred barbecue. Very few Jews today truly desire a restoration of the ancient temple. For those who see Tisha B'Av as the day to mourn the destruction of our ancient Jewish state, well, for 68 years now, we have had a newly revived Zion to welcome us. Israel is an accomplished fact. To spend so much energy on mourning what is gone, but has been restored for more than a generation, seems odd. So why is Tisha B'Av still observed? And why has it returned to the Reform movement over the last few decades? The answer lies in my people's deep understanding of history. For Jews, history is never truly gone. It continues always to affect our present and likely our future. We are shaped by the collective experiences of our people. As the Baal Shem Tov said, forgetfulness leads to exile, while remembrance is the beginning of redemption. If Pesach, Passover, is the history feast, Tisha B'Av is the history fast. We do well to remember the reasons the tradition attributes for the destruction of those two temples. The first, the great first temple, the rabbis tell us, was destroyed because of idolatry and the worship of false gods. But the destruction of the second temple was the result of sinat chinam, baseless hatred of one Jew for another. In other words, we allowed our internal disputes to fester, to destroy Jewish unity. Where we have always had respectful disagreements in the search for truth and justice, we instead turned to pure hostility of one Jew against another. This remains a powerful lesson today. When our community differs on substantive issues, as many do over the presidential election, for example, we must remember we are one people. Disagreement is natural and healthy. Hatred, vituperation, and attacking the integrity of the individual we disagree with is not. Tisha B'Av reminds us of the dangers of this and its consequences. We need just that sort of reminder to move us back towards the path of unity and Jewish cooperation. To play us in this morning, here's a beautiful setting of the powerful text from the Bible, Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right hand lose its power if I don't put Jerusalem as my greatest joy.
Yerushalayim, shamayim ala voisi mechosi im lo yezkirechi ve lo yare es yerushalayim ala voisi mechosi.
That was Imesh Kachech for Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, commemorated today. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Professor Ron Wolfson, is the author of the highly influential book Relational Judaism and a number of other books and explorations of American Jewish identity in the American Jewish world. Why is how we create community just as important as the specifics of what we stand for? Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish Dr. Ron Wolfson. He's the Fingerhut Professor of Education, Graduate Center for Education at American Jewish University in Los Angeles. He's the author, most famously, well, of a number of books, but of Relational Judaism. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Tell us a little bit about what's unique about the concept of Relational Judaism.
Well, the basic idea is that I believe Judaism is a relational religion. It's founded on the idea of covenant, which implies relationship between us and God, and I believe that Jewish institutions, particularly synagogues, ought to be relational communities where people are the most important things, not programs, not buildings, not websites, but the relationships, the sacred relationships we try to create between the individuals in our community. And that, I think, reflects an even more basic principle of Judaism, which is that every human being is made B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. So if we welcomed each other into relationship, got to know each other's stories, worked together to build a more perfect society with activities around social justice, learning, worship, our congregations would be much more vibrant institutions.
You know, I'm reminded of the old joke, Abe goes to Shul to talk to God and Moshe goes to Shul to talk to Abe.
That's right.
How different is this than that kind of eternal Jewish understanding that we form a kind of a minyan, a kehillah? How unique is this?
Well, I think that certainly one of the most important litmus tests of whether or not someone has really become engaged in the life of a sacred community is if you don't show up, people are worried about you. You know, what happened to Sam,
right,
who comes to talk to Schwartz, you know?
Right.
And that, I think, is really one of the most wonderful things about getting involved in a synagogue community. But if a stranger walks in and is not warmly welcomed, or a relative of the bar or bat mitzvah on a Shabbat, you know, comes to visit Tucson from Boston, and even if there's a greeter at the front door saying Shabbat Shalom, if no one else in the congregation comes up to say hello, and just spends his or her time kibitzing with their friends, then we're not really creating that kind of relational, welcoming community that I think is one of the most important things we have to offer in synagogue life, in an era of Facebook and social media that, on one hand, gets us more interconnected, but on the other hand, is not face-to-face sacred relationship building.
We will continue to explore the question and the concept of relational Judaism with Dr. Ron Wolfson, and we'll return in a couple of moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
You have a very wide range of ages in your clientele.
Yes, we do. Anywhere from 18 up to 90.
90. So people who are 90 decide they finally want to quit smoking.
Yes. They want to see their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren graduate high school and get married, go to college, that kind of thing.
It's incredible. What's the oldest person you've ever served?
Me personally, I had one that was 90. Last week, I had one that was 88. He's been with us for a couple of years and very, very pleased with how he quit, and his health is getting much better than it used to be.
You can breathe easier. You can smell things. You can taste things that you haven't been able to do so in years.
It's incredible. Where can people go to find out more information?
You can either visit us at our website at freedomsmokeusa.com, or you can call on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
And we have 4 stores around the greater Tucson area. We're in Catalina, Sierra Vista, and we're even in southern Michigan.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming them there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Thankfully, we have less than 3 months until we elect a new president of these United States. We continue with our 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. Joe Lieberman said he will vote for Hillary Clinton just days after leaving open the possibility he might vote for Donald Trump. I'm an independent Democrat, never changed parties, and I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton, the former senator from Connecticut said last week. Lieberman has known Clinton, the Democratic nominee, since he studied with her and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, at Yale Law School in the early 70s. I worked with her closely in the Senate for 8 years, Lieberman said. Clinton was the senator from New York from 01 to 09. She's strong, smart, understands national security. What I was most impressed with in our years in the Senate together was she reached across party lines to try to build coalitions to get something done. Joe Lieberman, whose wife and daughter are past guests of Too Jewish, was the first Jewish candidate on a major ticket when he was Al Gore's pick for vice president in 2000. He supported John McCain in 2008, and now he has endorsed Hillary Clinton. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently returned from Kiev in Ukraine. Most Americans think of Ukraine and think of Russian invasion and war, but that's not all that goes on there.
Right. Kiev is emphatically a city at peace. The fighting is very far to the east and is now kind of sporadic at worst. I think if you're in the war zone, you may feel differently about it, but Kiev does not look like a besieged city, and nobody walks around looking worried, and it was sunny and warm when I was there just a week or two ago. So what's interesting is Jewish tourism in Kiev and more generally in Ukraine, and I've been there probably 5 times. Most times with at least partially a Jewish tourism hat, if not an actual kippah.
Right.
And the very first time was the year I took off from college to go around the world. And on my way east, I didn't actually go all the way around the world. I went to Sri Lanka and back. And on the way east, I stopped with friends who were in Jerusalem in their junior year abroad, and we agreed to meet in Kabul, Afghanistan at the beginning of their Christmas break, and go through the former Soviet Union together. And this was in the days when there still was a Soviet Union. This was Brezhnev days. And they were going to bring chumashim and sidurim and other like Jewish articles, as many as they could. And probably they were going to be helped by the Jewish agency or somebody, some institution in Israel who would give them this stuff for free. So during that trip, we went to a lot of places in Central Asia. But one of the highlights of the trip was Kiev, because it was European and mostly Russian-speaking, but more sunny and warm and friendly somehow than the northern cities like Moscow and what was then called Leningrad. And our experiences in that trip inspired our campers at Camp Ramon, Wisconsin, to ask us to take them on a similar trip a couple of years later when they were on their way to Israel for the summer. And we did that back in the early 70s, wow, long before anyone else did Eastern European Jewish tourism. The March of the Living, all that stuff was undreamt of then.
Right. I mean, I remember my parents going and meeting with refuseniks on a secret mission as part of a, I don't know, it was Jewish agency, one of the Jewish groups to bring prayer books and the same kind, right, of thing that you're talking about.
Right. So we did this with 30 Jewish teenagers. And then I think I'll skip the intermediate trips and just tell you that recently when I was in Israel, several alumni of that original trip back in the 70s, of the 30 kids we took, six made Aliyah and now live in Israel. It's a pretty impressive percentage. Several have passed away, sadly. They're now roughly 60 years old, 59 in some cases. And they asked me, they approached me as like a committee, would I organize a kind of reunion trip? So partially in preparation for this trip, I decided to scout out Jewish tourism, especially for observant Jews in Ukraine today. And I think I'll share that with your listeners next week.
Sounds good, Tom. Thanks. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So you are very recently back from Israel, which we get to say frequently on this show. The Pride Parade, I've been at two of them in Tel Aviv. They're gigantic events. There was a big one in Jerusalem, too, which is not quite so comfortable. And there was after all last year a terrible stabbing of Shira Banki, who was killed. Tragic incident. Tell us about the experience of it this year for you.
So it just happened to be that I was there.
Like, that's how we ended up twice. Yeah. You know?
So I was in Jerusalem because I had two meetings in Jerusalem. So I came early, and the building of the Jewish agency, I had the meeting there. It's just at located like on the spot that the parade was supposed to end. So because of the what you just mentioned, it was like cleared like you see in the movies. Like when I stepped out of the building in order to go meet my family, I needed to cap to accompany me few blocks. Like I couldn't walk by myself. A policeman walked me until, like, and he said, you can go back. Like, if you left something, forget it.
Forget it. That's
it. It was so sterile, we say in Hebrew, I guess, sterile. Or
sterile. Yeah, sterile, like, yeah. Like they had cleansed the area of people.
Yeah, Gan Atzmaut was the place that the parade was, like, ended.
Right,
and
Park.
They had, like, ceremony with Shira Banki's father speaking, right, and other people speaking. Right. So for me, being in Jerusalem, I started early, as I said.
I used to live right near there. I mean, that big park and that. Go ahead.
So
I'm
being
sorry.
In the Kotel that day, and you know, you really, I felt that day that the huge gap and the huge differences between, you know, holiness and chol, like kodesh and chol, and you know. Pride,
the secular and the sacred.
And
right.
Everything like was so a big contrast and a big, you know, so, but it's good because this kind of extreme moment helping you learn about yourself and about your nation and about what's really important. And at the end of the day, I think like I was proud that it was in Jerusalem. I was afraid that it will be too extravaganza, like in Tel Aviv, which is good for Tel Aviv, not good for Jerusalem.
Right.
And it was the same day for Ha'ari HaKadosh. It was a big day for Ha'ari HaKadosh, same time in Har HaZeitim. So it was like a big contrast, like I saw
sure,
here.
And
so,
sure.
But at the end of the day, that's what that what makes us one nation and one, you know.
Well, it makes Israel
rich,
a real country, you know.
And a rich country.
A complicated
yeah.
and diverse
yeah.
and rich place.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's such a powerful experience. And it's fascinating the way you say, like, wouldn't have been right. What's right for Tel Aviv is not right for Jerusalem. And that's certainly true. And I do understand that the Jerusalem Pride Parade is much more, I don't know, much more dressed, much
yeah,
more respectful.
Dressed. Yeah.
Also very open and free, but not in the same way. Tel Aviv is over the top and Jerusalem is more serious place.
The message of the parade in Tel Aviv is different than Jerusalem.
Yeah,
that was
sure.
clear.
I'm sure. Thank you so much. We will
Thank
talk
you,
next week. We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Boker Or.
Connecting kids with Israel is a very important part of what we all try to do in Jewish education in
yeah.
America. We want them to be connected to their Jewish heritage, to the holidays, to have knowledge, but we really want them to be connected to Israel. It's
yeah.
not as easy a thing as you might think, and it's not as obvious the best way to do it.
Right. Well, you know, it's got to be intentional. You have to have a real effort to make those connections happen. They don't happen by themselves. And so it's all about programming and it's all about people and you know, having great people who are passionate about Israel, who believe in the importance of the American-Israel relationship and the relationships of Jews in the diaspora to Jews in Israel, really makes a difference. And we're fortunate in Tucson to have a lot of talent who comes from Israel or who has a heritage and a background that enables them to be a strong educator when it comes to Israel education.
We are in this community, I know we'll talk about another context with Oshrat Barel, but we have this Shin Shinim program in which we're bringing young Israelis to teach
yeah.
in our schools to
yeah.
kind of embed them, if you will,
right.
within the community. We don't know how it'll work, but we kind of think it will.
Mm-hmm. We're excited about these two. They're actually coming to THA next week for a planning meeting and getting things going. So they are going to be very busy.
That's the
They're
point,
be
isn't it?
All over the place at the JCC, doing Federation stuff, and in the synagogues. It's going to be a pretty exciting year for those two.
Be very active at our Temple Manual too, at services mm-hmm. with kids, with their youth group, teaching in the school. Having said all of that, is like just direct exposure to young Israelis somehow going to make our kids like Israel better?
Absolutely. Because, you know, country is about the people in the country. And culture is about the humans that live it and practice it. And so being around these people, I think, just by itself is going to be inspiring. There's the accent. There's the Hebrew knowledge. There's a different zest of life when you're an Israeli, I think. And so that really comes across. You know, I left out something important, too. I talked about people and programs. But you also have to have vision. And you have to have a priority of Israel education. It needs to be an institutional value so that everybody understands it's an important piece of what happens in your organization. And yeah, it comes right back to those people who are going to have a huge impact in Tucson this year.
We will talk next week and continue to explore Jewish education. Thanks, John.
Wonderful. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Three old Jews are sitting on a park bench quietly. One sighs and says, "Oi." The second sighs more loudly and says, "Oi." The third turns to the other two and says, "I thought we weren't going to talk politics." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the second portion of the book of Dvarim, Deuteronomy, the remarkable Sedra Vayetchanan. It includes truly spectacular texts. The Shema, the central statement of God's oneness in the world. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Which is followed immediately by the Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God with all our hearts, mind, and strength. And as if that were not enough honor for one Torah portion, Vayetchanan includes the recitation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, for the second time. If you were to rank Torah portions, you could easily put Vayetchanan near the top in quality of content. A portion that has the essence of Jewish monotheism, the Shema, and the Ten Commandments, centerpiece of all Western ethics, is a spectacular portion by anybody's standards. It's no accident that this powerfully affirming part is read the week after Tisha B'Av, on Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation. We take comfort in our knowledge that morality and holiness may ultimately bring justice. So what more can we possibly learn about these famous texts from our tradition? The Shema itself is really a simple statement. Listen, Israel, God is your Lord and God is only one. Straightforward. Something that should be easy both to understand and accept. Wholeness, oneness. So simple, in fact, anyone should be able to understand and embrace it. Although, of course, simple and true ideas often struggle for acceptance. But it's the text that follows the Shema in Vayetchanan, the Ve'ahavta, that is the more subtle and in many ways more intriguing passage. For in that prayer we are commanded to love God. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and heart. Many things in life can be commanded, but love is distinctly not one of them. What does the Torah mean when it says we are commanded to love God? Strange idea, but a powerful one. For love is essentially a kind of unconditional way of giving, of focusing attention and care on another being. Loving God means paying attention to God's existence in our world, to God's oneness, to God's moral code for all of us. We express our love of God, our ahava, by demonstrating that we have learned how to listen, shma. If we truly listen, then we will know that we must act ethically. Loving God means being obligated to listen and follow God's mitzvot, to live ethical lives and do so with energy and commitment. It also means that being good, morally good, is a form of love, perhaps the purest form. May we all find a way to express that love through righteous actions, through mitzvot. By doing so, we can affirm God in our world. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Professor Ron Wolfson, will explain what relational Judaism is, why it's so important for the Jewish community today. Find out when we return right here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, THAAZ.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
After an eight-year wait, Israel won its first Olympic medal since 2008 when Yarden Gerbi claimed a bronze medal in the women's judo competition at the Rio Games this week. She became the fourth Israeli judoka to take an Olympic medal, joining Yael Arad, Oren Smadja, and Arik Ze'evi in earlier Olympics. Israel's four other Olympic medals have come in either sailing or canoeing, two courtesy of Gal Friedman, including Israel's lone gold medal. Gerbi also became just the second Israeli woman to join a medal. American Jewish gymnast Ali Reisman added to her two Olympic golds and bronze from 2012 in London with another team gold and an individual silver, and there are events left to come as we go to press. Superstar Olympic swimmer Katie Ledecky is not Jewish. She's actually a practicing Catholic, but some of her remarkable motivation comes from her Jewish grandmother, Berta. When Katie was 10, Berta took her to a Jewish cemetery in Prague, showed her the graves of family members who died during the Holocaust. According to interviews, the memory clearly stuck with Katie, and that visit is often on her mind. In a less savory incident from the Rio Olympics, Lebanese Olympians refused to ride a bus with Israeli athletes to get to the opening ceremony of the Rio Games. When the Israeli delegation of athletes and coaches tried to board the bus to Maracana Stadium, the head of the Lebanese delegation blocked the entrance. To avoid an incident, organizers brought a separate bus for the Israelis. The Lebanese were reprimanded for their conduct by the IOC. And in non-Olympic news, a drone that entered Israeli airspace over the Golan Heights last month has been definitely identified as Russian. Last week, Russia admitted the July 17th infiltration, saying it was the result of human error. Israeli security services initially suspected Hezbollah, a Lebanon-based terrorist group, was behind the drone. Two Patriot anti-missile missiles and an air-to-air missile fired by a fighter plane failed to intercept the drone, which returned to Syrian airspace. Russian President Vladimir Putin sent his forces into Syria in September of 2015 in support of Syrian President Bashar Assad in the country's more than five-year-long civil war. The drone incident is the first time Israel fired on a Russian aircraft operating from Syria. It was the main subject of a telephone conversation between Vladimir Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu 6 days later. "We maintain regular contact with the Russians regarding Syria," Netanyahu said. "The risks of a confrontation between the IDF and the Russian army are not small, so the coordination between us requires constant maintenance. Both I and Russian President Putin view it this way, and this coordination will continue." Netanyahu and Putin have met four times in the past year, and they speak by phone every few weeks. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Ron Wilson. He's the Finkerhood Professor of Education at American Jewish University in Los Angeles, the author of a number of books. His most recent is The Best Boy in the United States of America, a memoir of blessings and kisses, and most famously, Relational Judaism, which we've been exploring today. Putting a title on something sometimes helps people understand what they're already doing, or maybe what they should be doing.
Correct. In fact, I think this is one of the main contributions people tell me that this book has helped them with, which is to put a name on something we already have been doing and to make the case for doing it better and deeper. So, for example, in many congregations on a Friday night, the rabbi will stand up and say, turn to a neighbor and say Shabbat Shalom, welcome. And that's great. In the church world, this is called passing the peace. My argument in the book is let's go deeper than just that sort of cursory introduction. Let's find ways in our congregations to hear each other's stories. And in the book, I present examples of institutions that are onto this now and have found ways to do it through strategies such as one-on-one coffee dates and small group meetings in people's homes and building small groups within the congregation where people really get to know each other. And that, I think, has been a good contribution to our conversation about how to make sure that synagogues are vibrant further into the 21st century.
I remember when I started a long time, 18 years ago here in Tucson, I had people get up at the end of the service and put their arms around the person next to them when we sang Shalom Aleichem, you know, not revelatory or anything. And our cantoral host, who'd been here for some years already, said, I cannot believe that people in Temple Emmanuel are actually putting their arms around people and singing Shalom Aleichem.
You know, 18 years ago, that was a new idea.
Yes.
And in some parts of the country, I know your podcast goes nationwide,
right.
It, particularly in the East Coast, it's still rather unique for people to do that in a synagogue. But I think that it's it warms up the ambiance. It gives permission for strangers sitting in the same place, experiencing what is supposed to be a spiritual experience, the permission to reach out to another person who they may not know, and build. At least the beginning of a relationship. I like to share the story of two friends of mine who go to the synagogue I attend, who came in a little late one Shabbat morning. This is a conservative synagogue. And two people were sitting in their regular seats. You know, this idea of...
Yeah, my seat.
you're sitting in my seat. So instead of saying, hey, you're sitting in my seat... they knew that two people were strangers because these folks who told me the story are regulars in our congregation, in fact, leaders of the congregation. So instead of saying, hey, you're sitting in my seat, which would have been a total turnoff to these people, they did exactly the right thing. They said, Shabbat Shalom, welcome to our congregation, may we sit with you. So the two people were thrilled with that invitation, moved over two seats.
And they got their seats anyway.
the members got their seats, but here's the key point, Rabbi. Here's the key point. During parts of the service when people have an opportunity to greet each other and schmooze, you know, the Torah parade and so on, they began to chat with these two strangers, and it turns out they were visiting from Toronto. They were not there for the bar mitzvah that morning. They had heard about Valley Beth Shalom. They wanted to come see what was going on. My friends, the members of the congregation, invited the folks from Toronto to sit with them at the Shabbat Kiddush lunch. And from this has developed a 30-year friendship.
Oh, my.
Now, how different is that than the stories I hear all the time from people who visit a congregation and no one says hello, or they get kicked out of a seat, which happened to me, as a matter of fact. So that's the beginning point of building relationships with people. Further on, we need to hear people's stories and really get to know them and build opportunities for people to have activities together that furthers those relationship building modalities.
So, you know, I'll add a horror story. When I first came here, I was at a meeting and one of the really gigantic donors in the community said, you know, when we first came here from, I think it was Nebraska, maybe it was.
Hey, I'm from Omaha.
Yeah, exactly. might have been Oklahoma. I apologize. To me, they're, okay. I know they're not really the same and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but they said when they came here, they came to my temple. I wasn't, it was long before I came to Tucson, and nobody said hello to them. And so they went over to the conservative shul, even though they came from a reform congregation, and joined there. And now they are the principal financial support. I said,
yes.
Boy, am I sorry.
Boy, am I sorry is right. It doesn't take much to turn someone off. Right. And when they first walk into a synagogue, you know, I've done a lot of studying, and I write about this in the book, of mega churches. So, for example, here in Southern California, Saddleback Church is a good example. And I've become friends with their famous pastor, Rick Warren. I take my students there every semester to see what they're doing. And one of the things he teaches, which is important for people to understand, particularly lay leaders of synagogues, is he asks the question, what's the first question that strangers or first-time visitors ask when they walk into a synagogue or a church? And the answer is not, where's the restroom? The answer is there anybody else here who looks like me, who's in my stage of life,
right?
Who I could potentially be friends with? And that's a great insight, because then the people who are the face of the congregation need to represent the diversity of ages and stages of life we're trying to attract. Often people think synagogues are just for families with little kids or elderly folks. And the truth is, you know, we need to be, I think, inclusive and reaching out to a wide variety of ages and stages and backgrounds to build our sacred communities.
I want to talk a little bit about social media and what that does for community and the kind of community it creates. I have close friends who talk about, oh, all these friends that they have that they're in constant contact with whom they physically haven't seen in 30 years, 40 years. It's something different. It isn't something that existed before. Or is it a modification of what we already have?
No, I think it has its power. You know, I think that, you know, I have a number of friends who are high school buddies, and you know, we check in with each other and we show each other photos of what's going on and people follow each other. I think that that's a good use of the technology, but there are limits. You know, and I think we get too dependent on it. So, you know, when a friend of mine in Omaha's mother died, I didn't post something on Facebook. I picked up the phone and called. You know, and the texting thing kind of gets under my skin. I mean, I see families sitting in a restaurant texting each other across a table. I mean, why not, you know, put down the machine for a few minutes and engage in a face-to-face conversation? So I think that things like Shabbat dinners and opportunities in synagogue to engage people face-to-face is really important going forward, because I think those opportunities are going to be fewer now that we're in this era of social media. So while I recognize the positives of it, I fear for some of it. Sherry Turkle, who's a professor at MIT, writes brilliantly about this, that she was strolling along a beach in Cape Cod one summer on a gorgeous day, and sure enough, there's a family walking down the beach, all four of them looking into their phones instead of, you know, enjoying each other's company and marveling in the beauty of the place. So I think that there is a danger of us depending on social media. I mean, on my birthday a couple years ago, I got 426 Facebook happy birthday greetings. 426.
Right. You're a popular guy, kind of.
I was so panicked about it, I didn't know what to do. I called my daughter, Javi, who's an expert in this.
Of course.
I said, what do I do? Do I like each of them? Or she said, oh, Dad, you can just kind of put up a general thank you for the birthday greetings. Well, I got four handwritten birthday cards that year. One was from my wife. One was from my daughter, Javi, and her family. One was from my son, Michael. The fourth one was from Valerie, my Chase Bank teller. And I couldn't believe it. I had been at the bank a week before my birthday, and Valerie was kind of engaging me in conversation during my visit. And I mentioned I was going to, you know, up north to Northern California to visit my grandchildren for my birthday, or just before my birthday. And so I get this handwritten birthday card, and it basically said, Dear Mr. Wolfson, happy birthday. How was your visit to your grandchildren? Next time they're in town, please bring them by the branch so we might meet them. Have a wonderful day. Sincerely, Valerie, your Chase Bank teller.
Right.
Now, I couldn't believe it. And then I went into the branch and asked Valerie if she had gotten training in this. And she said, well, we've been encouraged to engage our customers in a more personal way than we have. Now, you can't get more transactional than a bank. But if Chase Bank is doing engagement work with their clients, certainly our Jewish institutions ought to be doing a better job in getting to know our people and engaging them in more than small talk and really building those sacred relationships.
So in talking about this, and I think about it from a synagogue perspective, being a synagogue rabbi, congregational rabbi, it's always a challenge to offer enough attention to the people that want you. It can't simply fall on the clergy or the synagogue professionals. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. And when I meet with leaders of synagogues and it's one of the first things I say. You know, if you want to create a sacred community, it's not just on the clergy and the staff. That's important. People, the best, I don't know if you'll agree with me, Rabbi, but my friends who are rabbis will tell me the best compliment they get is when someone in their congregation says, she is my rabbi, or he is my rabbi. My rabbi indicates relationship. And I think people who join congregations, many of them, not all, but many of them do want a relationship with a clergy or someone on the staff. So there is that kind of tier of relationship. But even more critical, it seems to me, in keeping people part of a congregation is the relationship between member and member, peer to peer. And that means that the board members, the leaders, the volunteers have to really work hard at creating this ambiance of welcome and relationship building. It cannot be just on the rabbi. The rabbi is a very busy guy, as I'm sure you can attest to.
Sure. Lots of jokes about that, too.
Yeah, right. But in addition to what the rabbi can do, and there are many things rabbis are doing to further get to know their congregants, everyone has to be on the same page for this to work.
Right. I want to thank Ron Wolfson. I feel like we could continue for a long time more and just kind of scratching the surface here. His book is called Relational Judaism. I think it's a must read for anybody involved in the Jewish world and really kind of about how all organizations work. And his newest book is his memoir, The Best Boy in the United States of America. Ron, thanks so much. People can go to drronwolfson.com, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you, Rabbi, for inviting me to visit with you and your listeners.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg, Senior Vice President of the Chaim Solomon Center. Our playout this morning comes from Sam Glazer, his song Echa, music for Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av today. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week. And if you are not eating, an easy fast and a week, we pray, of peace.
Like a widow, the city sits alone. No more children, no more pilgrims on the road. Looking for the place called the joy of all the earth. Perfect in her beauty, she lies down in ashes and dust.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.